Live from Grandma's house, it's KVBL Simpsons Chat. I'm Dave, I'm the runner of this podcast.
I'm Melissa, I'm the faithful sidekick of this podcast.
And the episode is Moan and Lisa. For the few of you who are actually watching along with, I am pressing play now. Now, this is the episode you chose, so why did you choose this one?
This is my favourite episode. As anyone who is watching and listening will know, Simpsons just are one of those TV shows that invades your social life, whether you want it to or not. And I'm quite controversial in that I hate the later seasons with a passion.
Yeah, I'm sure there's heaps of people who disagree with me on that one.
And I really, really love the early seasons, and Moaning Lisa is just an episode that's always stuck out in my mind. And it wasn't until the DVDs came out and I re-watched it when I really realised how funny it was. So I found it quite interesting that in a show that's known for its comedy, my favourite episode was one I always just assumed was really, really sad. And being a lot older now, I remember watching it. It was always on TV when I was like 7. Because they just replayed the early seasons over and over and over.
That was back in the olden days when Fox and Channel 10 were screaming for more episodes to be made.
And there were only ever 2 ad breaks during the show.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, where they're supposed to go between the acts.
Yeah.
Back in the olden days.
Nostalgia. First episode, we're into the nostalgia phase. Alright, stuff's happening. All
right. But yeah, I've got to agree with you on that. I love this episode.
For the nitpickers at home, note the Glum brand toothpaste on the sink.
Yes. But I do love this because, I mean, when it comes to first season episodes, this is one of the most amount of character exploration, especially when it comes to Lisa. And also with Marge, I think people don't really notice it as much, but there is a lot of exploration with Marge as well.
I mean, in this episode, they essentially managed to lay out the personalities for the 4 speaking characters, and they work on Maggie a bit, and it stays that way for several seasons. Of course, the characters do get twisted and exaggerated, but kind of before that gets really annoying and anger-inducing, this episode just sets the basis of a lot of their motivations.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I really love about the first 3 seasons is that the show's really fresh. The writers are really, they're feeling their way around, and I mean, this is the first, this first project which Matt Groening actually had humans involved in it, and there's a bit of exploration. I mean, they're feeling their way around, and they actually created some awesome episodes, and the first 4 seasons contain the highest concentration of episodes that have made me weep at the end. and this, of course, is one of them. So, what do you think of Bleeding Gums Murphy? I mean, and his influence, and his sort of implied influence on Lisa as well.
One of the things I love about this episode is the dichotomy between Bleeding Gums Murphy and Mr. Largo. Because Mr. Largo, I think, just perfectly embodies every art or music teacher I've had who has just tried to suck the passion out of their students because they never, ever got anywhere in life and they're just incredibly bitter. And Bleeding Gums Murphy is just exactly the kind of person that you need to say, you know, there is good expression out there and you need to tap into that and you need to do what's right for you without letting anyone stomp on you, which I think anyone who's ever tried to be creative through the education system has come up against both those characters in their own ways.
I mean, I suppose, I mean, in my experience, because I was into the music, the music coordinator of my school was a little bit more towards the Bleeding Gums end of the line, especially if you played a brass instrument, which I did, and or the saxophone, because he loved big bands and he loved brass bands. And I was in both. Having played the trumpet, he was very English in the way he applied these things, but he still pushed creativity as far as he could in high school, really.
Just to tread on your high school reminiscing, we've had a couple of Lisa scenes here. And I want to point out one of the things, it was only really recently that I realised that Lisa is my favourite character, and I think it's only really if you watch the earlier episodes that you can kind of see why. But I remember on TV watching, what was it? It was The Simpsons. Oh, no, wait, it was The Brady Bunch, and then it was Neighbours, and then it was Roseanne, and then The Simpsons.
Ah, yes.
And pretty much in The Brady Bunch and in Neighbours, and for those of you listening in other countries who possibly don't get Neighbours, you're missing out on nothing, I can assure you. But pretty much, you know, it was the girls' roles to kind of sit back and look pretty, and in Neighbours they got screwed over by boys a lot and then went into fashion.
Of course, now they're all getting pregnant and becoming lesbians.
Hey, the lesbians came first. And then kind of in The Simpsons and Roseanne, you had these daughter characters who kind of thought outside the box. I mean, Lisa had a beautiful quote in that lunchroom scene that we've talked over where she says, "Every day at noon they hear us in here for feeding time. We sit around like cattle chewing our cubs, dreading the inevitable."
Yeah, there's one thing I love about these scenes is that it sets up this idea that Lisa is always a bit different from everybody. And and I've never seen that it is being a product of her intelligence. It's just that she is different from everybody. Even, for example, when she's a member, later on, when she's a member of the Super Friends, she's the only member of the Super Friends who does not have a nickname. That, you know, you've got your Database and Ham and Lisa. That even in a group of nerds, she is still sort of standing out, and she's still a little bit different. And this sort of analysis of this feeding time idea is all part of that. And in, you know, when she becomes a vegetarian, that continues that. So she's very much, you know, deliberately separated herself and become, you know, they've become quite different. Lisa's become aware of the writers, who it's quite obvious through the commentaries when they became vegetarian and whatnot, became quite ostracized and separated because of it.
Just about it. I love this moment here where Homer is trying to cheer Lisa up, and it's just not working, but she says, "Thanks, Dad, I know you mean well."
Yeah.
And I just think Homer and Lisa, I don't think, have a lot of interaction on episode-by-episode basis. They tend to have a few episodes where they're lumped together and that's their development. So I really do love it when you get small scenes, particularly like you do in the early seasons, where you just have this little interaction. Mm-hmm. And the family interaction is very, very normal in the early seasons, like the scene coming up here where Bart and Lisa are fighting over Maggie's affections. And I remember me and my brother used to argue over which of our parents loved us more. And it's just such a typical sibling thing to do.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've got to admit that there isn't very much Homer Lisa stuff, and all of it's quite gold, especially when Lisa and Homer break into the ISIS exhibit.
Yes.
That is incredibly awesome, and it contains some amazing directing, you know, when it comes to the composition of those scenes, which I suppose we should really save for that episode. But their dynamic is always very good when the writers actually put the energy into making it.
Like, this is one of the episodes where I think I love the B storyline just as much as the A storyline, which is, of course, Homer and Bart and the video boxing.
Mm-hmm.
And Homer's having a small crisis because he's essentially realising that Bart doesn't need him, because Bart is just able to take care of himself, represented through just constantly kicking Homer's butt. Mm. And I think it's quite interesting that they kind of brought this crisis of children growing apart from their parents in so early. I mean, I think in the Brady Bunch, it was only towards the later seasons where they really kind of addressed that teenagers get a little bit moody during puberty, like when they'd run out of wacky hijinks.
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, a lot of the episodes do thrive on conflict, and they do thrive on this idea of the children sort of separating. There's a really good scene in, for some reason, the episode escapes me, where Lisa is just talking to Homer, and she says, we're very different people, and we're just going to, you know, be driven further apart because I'm a very different person from you.
Mm.
And, of course, Homer's standing on an escalator, and he gets pulled away. And but as you're talking about the B storyline, I mean, I was a bit meh about the B storyline because it felt too much like they were trying to inject humour into what is essentially quite a sad story.
Well, I think it needed the humour.
Oh, yeah. I mean, although I do, to a certain extent, I identify with Homer because, you know, when I was a kid, I wasn't very good at games like that. you know, anything that required hand-eye coordination, I really sucked ass, which is the reason why I got into point-and-click adventure games.
Enough about you, talk about Bleeding Gums.
Talk about Bleeding Gums. I love this initial part where Lisa is hearing him play music because... The reason why jazz caught on is because it had this jazz and blues, is it had this inherent freedom associated with it.
Mm.
And it really comes across in the music as you hear it echoing across the streets. And you can see that Lisa is striving for that sort of freedom of expression that she's being stifled at school and at home. Did you have something to say about that? Previous scene there? You look like you wanna...
The dream scene that we're talking over yet again. I love that Marge has this dream where her mother is telling her to just repress all your negative feelings and it's only what you show on the outside that's important. And later on in the episode where Marge feeds the same message to Lisa, I do think it is nice that one of the themes that they kind of carry on in The Simpsons with the vein of parenting is that they tend to focus on it more with Homer, with the issues he had with his dad growing up and how he's essentially just pushing the same problems onto Bart and they have the same sort of dysfunctional relationship. But I think it's very good that they established early on that Marge doesn't want to repress her children the way her mother repressed her. And it's something that she... kind of fights out against several times. Mm. She's the parent who says, you know, I'll love you no matter what you do, whereas Homer's the parent. Particularly in the early seasons, he's more like, you've got to be normal, and in later seasons, he's more like, just don't screw up.
I mean, yeah, it doesn't come over... I mean, Fear of Flying is another episode where her repression comes out a bit.
And the one where she's a bodybuilder.
It comes out a little bit when Bart gets... is trying to get the money for the Radioactive Man comic book. Three Men in a Comic Book, where Marge is flashbacking to when she, you know, cleaned her sister's panty shields and for an Easy Bake Oven, which is horrendously cliched 70s, but it very much illustrated a lot of this. And, you know, Marge has this... It's always in the background more than anything else, but this idea that she's sort of trapped in this sort of upbringing of being pushed downwards, and occasionally she sort of punches her way out of the paper bag and sort of, you know, asserts herself, but then, you know, ends up getting pushed down by an overly dominant husband, which is a very interesting sort of frustration that is always there.
And one that I'm sure many housewives feel.
Yes. I've got a list, actually, of every single appearance Bleeding Gums Murphy has.
Oh, God.
And there are not many.
Not many.
Which is it. I mean, a lot of fans rave about him. Yeah, his appearances are very minor. I mean, this episode, obviously. He's in Dance and Homer, and he sings a 26-minute anthem. He's in Lisa's Pony. He gives Bart Simpson a 10 for his impersonation of Lunch Lady Doris. Radio Bart, where he sang We're Sending Our Love Down the World, is one of the many.
Yep.
And Round Springfield, where he dies. Yes. And of course, but his influence is always there. I mean, when Lisa stitches him into the family quilt, which is reflective of his influence in her musical life, which is a very important part of her. But actually, I find you say, how did Marge know that was Lisa from on the other side of town? But
I like to think that Marge has heard Lisa playing enough that she can identify her daughter's motifs in music.
Also, there aren't many baritone saxophone players around.
No, I do love in that scene.
Also, do you recognise this animation? They use this in the closing credits for One Fish, Two Fish, Three Fish, Blue Fish.
Ah.
No, it was
One Fish, Two Fish. Primes.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Sorry, I just feel like pointing out recycling animation because it annoys me.
Let them go, okay? They're trying as hard as they can.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, sorry, I'll keep going.
I just love Bleeding Gumsmith. It's like a throwaway line where he says you play pretty well for someone with no real problems.
Oh, well, that's my phone.
Busted. Anyway. But I do kind of love, because both of us have hung out in music circles because we were too uncoordinated to play sports, but it is something that crops up that, you know, if you're good at music, you're expected to be like this tortured soul. And we were talking earlier about how Lisa is almost a bit of a prodigy just because the type of the saxophone she plays and how well she plays it is amazing for someone who's meant to be her age.
Mm.
And, you know, she's like 8 years old.
Mm. And, I mean, I'll mention this when we were watching this earlier, that, yeah, she's... I suppose, I mean, I don't know why they went for a baritone, but it's impossible for someone her age to play a baritone because the keys are too far apart. And later on you find out that she plays with a 4.5 reed, which is incredibly difficult for anybody. I mean, it's a sort of, it's a thickness reed that the professionals use, because it gets a wonderful tone, but it's incredibly hard. You need a lot of breath discipline. So it's I don't know, it's quite subtle that she's very good, but...
Those of you at home, I hope you're writing this down, so next time you're watching this with friends, you can just pull that little factoid out.
Yes, yes. Well, I went home and turned around and looked like a monkey. But one of the things that I like about this when it comes to Homer's character is also that it emphasises his childishness. He is at heart a child, and that is the reason why people love him.
I do think in later seasons they kind of... limit the childish thing and just make him seem like a simpleton.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the fact is that in the early seasons he's got some good solid ideas and, you know, he probably didn't get as most out of his education as he could have, but he's not an idiot. He just kind of has this view on life that means he doesn't take things seriously or he doesn't think things through. And that kind of complexity to him gets thrown away for preference of a lot of cheap gags.
Mm-hmm. I mean, like, the way in which he, you know, put his hand up to play him in the boxing and the... I mean, just the very fact that he's obsessed over a video boxing game. As you sort of highlighted before, it brings up this conflict within him with Bart, but it also brings up that, you know, he takes video games very seriously. He takes these, you know, something which... You know, someone his age really shouldn't be taking seriously.
Never too old for video games.
The woman in the video game parlor said, "No man of your age, you should know better than to spend all your time playing these video games." And I don't know. It's again. I mean, like I said, it's early character exploration. It's sort of laying down this map, which was, you know, it was obeyed for, you know, several seasons at least, and is one reason why I do like Homer's character. Although I am a Lisa fan like yourself.
I'm just saying that to placitate me.
Yeah.
Just to go back to the A and B storylines, because you, of course, just... The Simpsons can never meet your high expectations. But I think it was a really good choice to pair these two together, because essentially they are storylines about, you know, Marge and Homer trying to find ways to connect with their children. And in Marge, she tries to connect with Lisa by being a positive influence and helping her, whereas with Homer, he tries to connect with Bart by just being someone that Bart can look up to.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way he can achieve that is to excel at something that Bart excels at. So almost rather than, you know, pushing a son to follow in his father's sporting footsteps, he's just chasing after Bart's own goals, which I like.
Well, Bart doesn't even like going in the bathroom after Homer. But actually, I do love that part where Marge does a burning U-turn and grabs her and pulls her in the car. I mean, every time I watch that episode with the sound on, I get this real energy, glowing energy, because I'm really proud of Marge there. And I just really love her there. And she doesn't. I mean, she's trying to get Lisa to be a good girl, but also wants her to be a little bit more free than she was when she was young.
And just the pep talk that she gives Lisa in the car afterwards, where she says, "You know, if you need to be sad, then be sad, and we'll ride it out with you."
Yeah.
And I kind of think that is just a perfect breakdown of the kind of thing that every family member says when another family member is struggling.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, the sort of relationship between Marge and Lisa is always very positive.
There's some very sensitive writing in this episode, which is why I love it so much.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Homer whimpering on the floor. And in the commentary for the episode, they said this is that, yeah, if you pull a game out right at a really crux moment like this, they will whimper.
I used to do it to my brother all the time.
I've done it myself. Because back in the old days, I had an Atari, one of those Lynx handheld games things, and it had a really dodgy power cord. So every now and then, it'll cut out just at a really bad moment. And yes, it's horrendously painful. But as this episode comes to a close, I'll just...
In the jazz hall.
One thing that the writers could have gone for, which they didn't, was this idea of Bleeding Gums being like a type of mentor sort of character for Lisa. And, you know, while I could see the potential for that sort of thing, I can, in hindsight, like the idea at the time, I can understand why they didn't. Firstly, because they would have had to get this voice actor in on a regular basis to be able to do Bleeding Gums, but it would have removed a lot of the potential between Lisa and her parents. It would have become a little bit too comfortable a fallback for her to go to him.
I don't know, because I think they were smart by setting up in this episode one of Bleeding Gums' early lines is, you know, I can't help you with your problems, I'm just a jazz hound.
Mm.
And I think it would have been good if Lisa had been able to go to Bleeding Gums for helps with expressing herself, but, you know, the main crux of her own problems is saying that she'd have to overcome herself.
Mm-hmm.
To be perfectly honest, given some of the ugly crap Simpsons episodes that are in existence, I would prefer that they had possibly jeopardized Lisa's interaction with her parents by bringing back a character who, you know, has a little bit of development, who has some depth to him, you know, rather than fucking packing celebrities in.
Yeah, I suppose the thing is the having a continuing guest character is a bit of a problem with a half-hour comedy because people don't like continuing storylines in comedies. It's,
Oh, yeah, but how many times do they bring back fucking Sideshow Bob?
Yeah, well, you can watch them in isolation. And, in fact, in the first four or five episodes, they actually list every single crime he committed up to that point. So they actually do bring it, and it's easy to bring them up to speed, you know, they're watching this, oh, no, Sideshow Bob, and Homer goes, who? And then they say, don't you remember he did this, 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 and this? But seeing it's all based on this complex relationship with Lisa, it'll be a little bit harder to pull off properly.
I think it could have been done, but I'm not going to hold a grudge because they didn't do it.
And Round Springfield, where he dies, is an awesome episode.
This is indeed true.
I'm sure we'll be doing a podcast about that at some point.
And we'll try to leave out our high school nostalgia for you at home.
Anyway, so that's Mooning Lisa. I haven't yet set up the Live Journal community, so I can't give out the address for it right now. But
do we have an email address?
No.
give them the address of the podcast.
They should know it. But anyway.
We could have pirated off LimeWire.
Okay. KBBL.jellycast.com. Took me a bit of thinking.
I'm sorry, guys. I'm so sorry.
Okay, well, until next time, we'll catch you later.
Bye.